Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Judith Enk, who has served as Regional Administrator of Region 2 for the United States Environmental Protection Agency since 2009. She has previously served in a variety of roles in New York, including Deputy Secretary for the Environment in the Governor's Office, Policy Advisor to the Attorney General, Senior Environmental Associate with the New York Public Interest Research Group, and Executive Director of Environmental Advocates, among other positions. Enk is a graduate of the College of St. Rose in Albany, and, may I add on a personal note, one of my favorite people in the whole world. Judith Enk, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Alan. It's great to be here.
Well, you've really come such a long way. Tell us what you're doing now. What does this job entail?
Well, I've got one of the best jobs in the federal government. The way EPA is set up is we've got this terrific administrator, Lisa Jackson, and she selected 10 people to serve as regional administrators because the agency is split into 10 different regions. And I clearly have the best region, which is New York, New Jersey, the 8 Indian nations of New York, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. So it's sort of like two regions, the metropolitan region and the Caribbean. And I basically deal with every major pollution problem in these areas. I've got a fantastic staff of 900 people, very seasoned engineers, scientists, lawyers, policy folks, who come into work every day with no political interference and do their job. They work to make sure that underground oil spills are cleaned up, that we have safe drinking water, that air pollution is reduced. And it's just a wonderful opportunity, and I'm having a ball.
And I suppose having both the Caribbean and New York and New Jersey, that you spend one day here and one day on the beaches down there?
Oh, yeah. I'm really just goofing off when I'm in the Caribbean. No environmental problems to work on at all there. I spend more time in Puerto Rico than I expected. And it's because the problems are serious and solvable.
For instance,
there's no recycling to speak of in Puerto Rico. So we launched something called the Puerto Rico Recycling Partnership, where we work with the local government, with businesses, with the environmental community and EPA. EPA can't just sweep in. We're a big lumbering federal agency. We can't just sweep in and say, okay, everyone start recycling. We've got to pull everyone together, find markets for the material, do public education. It was sort of where New York was 25 years ago. Another issue that's huge in Puerto Rico and surprised me, still a big problem in New York and New Jersey, is the safe disposal treatment of sewage. There are neighborhoods in Puerto Rico, in San Juan, that do not have water infrastructure. So I've toured low-income neighborhoods where there are pipes and hoses coming out of people's homes, raw sewage literally flowing in the streets. Mm. I was told it's been a problem for 60 years. Oh, Judith, you're never going to solve it, which is the wrong thing to say to me. So we're now working closely with the local government there, with community groups, with the Department of Justice, because there are violations of the Clean Water Act, and we're going to solve that problem. So a lot of the issues in the Caribbean are solvable if you've got the right people focused on it, and you know the big challenge is enough resources.
Now you said, and I was fascinated by it, that your people don't face political connections, and I'm wondering how could that possibly be? I mean, if politics is the authoritative allocation of scarce resources, everybody's always trying to get something, aren't they?
Well, I'm a little sheltered from that being in a regional office. We're like the environmental cop on the beat. And the problem is there are not enough resources to go around.
Sure.
But most of the calls that I get from elected officials is for EPA to do more.
Sure.
So what I find fascinating is if you follow the Washington media, you know, there's sort of this attack on EPA. A number of presidential candidates say we shouldn't exist, regulatory overreach. The reality is many in that same party are critical of me for not being more aggressive in their districts on local environmental problems. So there's a real disconnect. So I have the luxury of not being in the Washington echo chamber. I can just deal with cleaning up toxic waste sites, trying to get people connected to clean drinking water supplies, doing what Richard Nixon envisioned the agency would do when he established it 41 years ago.
My doctoral dissertation advisor Dr. Elena Padilla wrote the first book on in-migration from Puerto Rico called Up from Puerto Rico. And so I guess my question to you is there still a nexus between Puerto Rican politicians in New York and those in Puerto Rico who are trying to garner assets, as you just indicated they do, for important projects?
Well, what I've experienced is there's certainly political influence of the people of Puerto Rico in the Congress, in the mainland here. And I've experienced it as a force for good. For instance, I'm very involved in trying to clean up the island of Vieques. For 60 years, it was a bombing range for
Indeed.
NATO and the military. The bombing stopped. But all those unexploded bombs and bullets and grenades now litter two-thirds of this beautiful tropical island and all the water around it.
My boy was just there, and I said, don't go there. He said,
oh,
no, it's all okay.
It's okay. It's okay. Everyone should go to Vieques. It's beautiful. But two-thirds of the island, ironically, is a Department of Interior wildlife refuge filled with bombs and bullets that EPA is in charge of getting rid of because it's a federal Superfund site. So I hear from Puerto Rican elected officials to speed it up on cleaning up Vieques. I hear from them on a proposed natural gas pipeline in Puerto Rico. So there's a tremendous amount of interest, but the push on me has been to be more protective of the environment.
Wow. So give us all a little history. I read them very quickly. But you worked for a lot of New York State politicians. Did you start at NYPIRG at New York Public Interest Research Group?
My first job actually was at Environmental Advocates, where at the young age of 23, I was the executive director.
How did you get that job?
Well, some would say I peaked too early.
Andrew Cuomo said that the other day about his father. He said when he ran for president, he peaked too early. He said it wasn't going to happen to him, which I took as a sort of, indication he might run for president.
I had a different career trajectory. I started at Environmental Advocates because I really wanted to pass the bottle bill. I was a college intern at NYPIRG working on the bottle bill. I didn't get it passed. So I actually started as the office manager at Environmental Advocates. They paid me $100 a week. I rode my bicycle all over Albany, and I lobbied for the bottle bill. It passed, and then they hired me as executive director, which was it's not that impressive. The staff was 1.5 people, me being one, and a mountain of debt. So I started there, and then 10 years at New York Public Interest Research Group as an environment. I had a great job. Half my time was working with communities on local environmental hazards, and then the other half of my job was walking around the state legislature and state agencies to try to improve the environment. And I purposely designed it that way, so I wanted to stay really close to the grassroots and what was happening there, take that information and experience and utilize it to work on statewide policy change. So I did that for 10 years. That flew by like a blink. And then,
but before we go there, NYPIRG, I want to ask you about NYPIRG. In the beginning, we used to kid around about it. One kid sitting under a light bulb. NYPIRG is a very respected institution now. It's had quite an evolution.
Yeah, and it's turned out a lot of very effective people who work in the public interest, including, little known fact, President Obama worked for one semester for NYPIRG at City College. NYPIRG is an interesting phenomena. I think it's student driven, but it's hired lots of professional staff that, work hard there. It's really long hours, really low pay, and it's the best job you'll ever have.
Okay, so I interrupted you after NYPIRG.
So NYPIRG, then I went and worked for Elliot Spitzer when he was Attorney General, stayed for 8 years as his environmental policy advisor. That was really interesting, working with a seasoned team of lawyers and scientists who essentially were litigators. So it was, at the time, George Bush II, Jr. was president, and he was very involved in rolling back environmental statutes. And so the Attorney General's office would sue. And in fact, when I left, I tallied up the number of times that the New York Attorney General's office, working in partnership with the Massachusetts AG, the Connecticut AG, and others, the Attorney General's office sued 16 times and often won to protect key provisions of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. So it was sort of interesting how that timing turned out. And I think it was really good that Eliot Spitzer was attorney general during that time when the federal government was walking away from environmental statutes.
By way of disclosure, I just have to say I not only like Eliot Spitzer and have tremendous respect for him and we're friends, but I think I sort of inject that into it. But let me ask you, did you have any FaceTime with him?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And what was that like?
It was terrific. He's really smart. Going in, a lot of people wondered why I would want to work for him. And over the years, different AGs have invited me to go work for them. And I always said, oh, I'm not old and burnt out yet. I don't want to go hang out in state government. I've got too much to do. But Spitzer impressed me as someone who not only was smart, but was strategic. And I know his narrative is what everyone knows. And
sure.
What's sad is his 8 years of attorney general should not be diminished. He did some amazing things. And I often think if he was in elected office while Wall Street was imploding, for instance, could the outcome have been a little different than it has been?
Good point. Did you ever have a disagreement with him while you were there?
Oh, all the time.
What was that like?
Ferocious. I mean, we would have staff meetings and it was almost like moot court and he would ask you questions and he would often take the opposite position and you had to defend your position. I loved it. You walked into the meetings knowing the facts. And what I always found interesting is when he then became governor, I was deputy secretary for the environment. He knew my...
So we all understand deputy secretary for environment is the chief. There's a secretary to the governor. And then all the deputy secretaries are the heads of that particular substantive area. And that's what your job was.
Right. And so I had oversight for all the environmental agencies and a bunch of them, not just DEC, Department of Environmental Conservation and State Parks, but Adirondack Park Agency, Agriculture and Markets, Department of State, et cetera. And you would always get late night emails from the governor asking questions, very detailed questions. And I always felt like he knew my to-do list better than I knew my to-do list. So he was very involved in the day-to-day policy decisions.
Wow. You went to the College of St. Rose. I want to go back.
Oh, that's really a long time.
No, I know. But I was struck because last night I was watching, as we speak, I was watching 60 Minutes and there's this billionaire who was on it. And he was paying people $100,000 to drop out of college and pursue some major area, you know, and he pointed to, he didn't give them money, but he pointed to people like Steve Jobs who dropped out, you know, and Zuckerberg who dropped out and all these other guys and said, basically, college teaches you, college isn't that good. How much did the St. Rose prepare you for all of this? In other words, intellectually.
Intellectually. Pretty well. I mean, I was a political science and history major, but when I was a junior, I started doing internships in Albany. That's one of the benefits of St. Rose. You can just take the bus downtown and get involved in state government. I also think St. Rose instilled in me the view that you know, you can serve the public in your career. You know, it's interesting. There's a strong tradition from the Sisters of St. Joseph there. Most of the students there are teachers, social workers, speech pathologists. I'm not that good. I can never do any of those things. But I can take that commitment to, you know, what a lot of the sisters called social justice and work in my day-to-day work. I just saw a bunch of my St. Rose friends last weekend, and they're doing amazing work all over the country. And I think more than what we learned in the classroom was our experiences outside the classroom, spending a summer, for instance, building houses in Louisiana, and the story behind that, and the push to do things outside of the classroom, I think had a big impact on a lot of students there. It's a great college.
So assuming that somebody had just handed you a BA and said, you don't have to go to college, would you be a different person now?
No, I would be doing exactly the same thing.
So I guess I tried to trap you there, and maybe you fell for it, and maybe not.
No, I think I did fall for it.
Yeah.
So, I have to be honest.
So in other words, should we send our kids to liberal arts institutions?
Yes, absolutely, because and more liberal arts institutions than training for what your next job may or may not be. when I went to college, you know, my thought was I would be a social worker. I never envisioned that I would have a 30-year career doing environmental protection and have just tremendous fun along the way. A liberal arts education makes you think much more broadly. And it's the classics, and it's philosophy, and it's religion classes. It's not just an MBA factory.
So I guess I want to ask you, how dangerous are our environmental problems right now? I mean, you know, we learn so much later. So we learn, I have no memory. I was thinking that maybe it's because I ate paint chips as a kid leaning out the window on 96th Street. I don't know. I say that because I don't really remember if I ate paint chips.
They're sweet. If you were a kid in a lead painted apartment, you probably did eat paint chips.
Exactly. Are we living in a very dangerous world?
We're living in a toxic world, a world that our parents and grandparents didn't live in. There are 80,000 chemicals used in commerce. Only a few hundred of them have been tested for their health impacts. Mm. What I'm always struck by is you look at a particular chemical or a particular pollutant. Over time, the federal standards get stricter. It's hard for me to point to, you know, lead requirements being relaxed, asbestos exposure requirements being relaxed. We learn more and we ratchet down what we think is a safe exposure. Rarely does it go the other way. And our bodies are exposed to lots of different contaminants. It's in the air we breathe, the water we drink, the food we eat, the consumer products we touch every day. And on one hand, there's been tremendous progress on environmental protection. More people are drinking cleaner drinking water than they did when the Clean Water Act was adopted 40 years ago. Just look at air quality. I looked at some photographs recently of New York City, George Washington Bridge in the 70s. It wasn't fog we were looking at. It was smog. Remember Southern California. So those issues where you have strong federal environmental statutes that are effectively enforced, they've made a real difference. But there's a whole new generation of environmental challenges before us, not to mention what I think is the most serious challenge of our time, which is climate change. And, you know, we've got some pretty significant challenges ahead of us, which is why I'm puzzled by the national debate over rolling back environmental protections.
Well, you know, I'm so glad you asked that. But first, let me go to Judith Enk, ask you this question. You now are, you know, the top person for our region and environment, so designated by the federal government. I have a lot of things I want to ask you about, but how did you get appointed to that top job? I mean, certainly I would have done it. You say to anybody, who's Mrs. Environment in the New York State region? It was going to be you. But how did that happen? Can you remember it?
Oh, yeah, I can remember it. It's a political appointment. I'm appointed by the president. And historically, there's been competition between New York and New Jersey. And for years and years and years, the person who held that position was from New Jersey. So I was just plain lucky that there was a desire to put a New Yorker in that position.
Who was pushing for that?
Pushing for a New Yorker?
Yeah. You said a desire. Who's
desire? Yeah, different elected officials. And I think the administration in Washington, you know, it's not written down that there is, you know, New York, New Jersey, New York, New Jersey. But I think New Jersey had the seat for like 16 years. So to be honest, the way I got the job was the way I've gotten most of my jobs in my career. Is I took a deep breath and I picked up the phone and I called Administrator Lisa Jackson. She was not administrator at the time. She was being considered.
And you knew her?
Well, we knew each other by reputation and we didn't know each other personally. She was in New Jersey. She was the environmental commissioner there. And then she was Governor Corzine's chief of staff for a brief period. And I was sort of, I had no political connection to the Obama administration at all. I was just watching sort of the parlor games in the media of who is being considered to head up the EPA. And there were sort of a list of names, and some of them were like, that would be nice. Oh, ho-hum. And then I saw Lisa Jackson's name, and I said, well, that's someone I would want to work for and who I would actually leave the Capital District for and move to New York City. So I sort of watched with interest, and before Administrator Jackson was named, I called her up and said, hey, if you get this position, I'd like to talk to you and explore the idea of working together. I didn't necessarily want to do it for some of the other people that were being considered. But the president, thankfully, in I think a really smart appointment, appointed her to be the head of the EPA. And then we just kept talking.
Have you ever talked to the president?
Very briefly last week when he was in Albany.
So tell me, what's that relationship between you and Lisa Jackson turned out to be?
Oh, it's terrific. I think she is the best administrator the agency has ever had. And the agency has had a lot of good administrators. She testifies in Congress more than any other administration official, which is fascinating because you think of Kathleen Sebelius, the brilliant Health and Human Services head who is defending health care. Lisa Jackson is in the hot seat in Congress more than Kathleen Sebelius, answering detailed questions about any number of environmental issues. And she does it with such patience and grace. They lob, sometimes really crazy questions, and she just calmly responds. She's very calm. She's very professional. So she's steering the agency through politically choppy waters, and her message to her staff is always follow science and the law, just do your job. And, I've got your back in Washington. So I think she's brilliant, and I think it's going to be a really, it's a great time to be at the EPA.
So I want to pursue that. But if the Republicans, or some of the Republicans and the Tea Partiers and some of the others, are talking about the abolition of the EPA, what would that mean?
Well, first of all, I don't think it would ever happen. I don't think the public would allow that to happen. But it would mean you would not have an environmental cop on the beat dealing with federal environmental issues.
Isn't that what they want?
That's exactly what they want. Yeah. And you would
unfettered business.
Some of them. And sort of market-based pollution controls, saying that, companies on their own will decide what level of pollution is and isn't okay. And the problem with that approach is it doesn't deal with what academics call environmental externalities. For instance, not to get too into the weeds, but there's a proposed regulation to deal with pollution from power plants. The cost-benefit analysis typically deals with the cost of installing modern pollution controls on the top of the smokestack. Environmental externalities say you need to look at things like, if you don't reduce the pollution, how many asthma attacks are there and how much money does it cost to not only treat the asthma attacks, but lost work days, lost days at school. When you don't have strong environmental regulation, you don't have the full picture. You get the costs, but you don't get the benefits. But I think, the United States without an EPA would mean a much higher level of pollution and diminished protection of public health.
And what does Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, think about the EPA?
Well, he doesn't speak out much specifically on the EPA, but he has done things like pulled his state out of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, the REGI system. That's a cap and trade program for carbon emissions. He's put in place a regulation called the waiver rule, where businesses can apply to get waivers from environmental regulations and things like that. So I think he's in the old world of thinking you can't have environmental protection and economic development at the same time.
Mutually exclusive.
Yeah, which I strongly disagree with. And, New Jersey has quite a proud leadership position on environmental protection matters, going back to Governor Florio, the current senators Lautenberg and Menendez are real environmental leaders in Congress. So it's a funny matchup in New Jersey, and I hope that over time You know, the economic benefits, you know, the tourism industry in New Jersey. You don't want water pollution affecting the Jersey Shore, for instance. So I think there will be an acknowledgement of those connections, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Do you think that New Jersey gets a bad rap? As a kid, as a young professor, I taught at Rutgers at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. And I lived in New York, and I used to get in my little Volkswagen and go through past Engelhard Industries and some of those other smokestacks, which were really horrible. And my view of New Jersey was incredibly colored, as I think everybody who's ever gotten in a car and gone past those that one section of factories hasn't said, so this is New Jersey, but there's a lot more in New Jersey. So I'm sort of wondering, have you been able to deal with that particular thing that I had to contest with? I mean, I literally held my breath for what seemed like eight minutes as I went through there.
Well, it's funny. I love New Jersey. People from New Jersey tend to identify themselves on what exit of the highway they're from, or the New Jersey Parkway. When I was first thinking about going to EPA, ironically, we made a family trip down to Washington. We drove through New Jersey, and I got this pit in my stomach thinking, who's in charge of cleaning up New Jersey? And now it's partially me. There are beautiful areas of New Jersey, absolutely beautiful. New Jersey also has the distinction of having the most federal Superfund sites than any other state in the country.
Explain to everybody what a Superfund site is.
Superfund is a toxic waste site. If it's really heavily contaminated with toxic chemicals, it becomes a federal Superfund site as opposed to a state Superfund site. For instance, the Hudson River, because of GE's PCB pollution, is a federal Superfund site. So New Jersey has more Superfund sites than any state in the nation. It has major water quality problems, and parts of it are beautiful. I'm spending a lot of time in Newark, in Camden, and those are really important cities that need environmental sustainability as they redevelop. And it's been really interesting working on these urban environmental challenges. We just had the mayor of Camden, Dana Redd, speak at the EPA. And Camden has a lot of problems with criminal justice and education. Mayor Redd has developed the most extraordinary environmental record of accomplishment in the last 2 years. And a lot of the environmental issues that we care a lot about are actually being tackled at the local level by mayors and city council members, not necessarily governors.
So you keep mentioning we, your family. How did all of that happen? And how's that affected you?
Well, I married in 1982, so my 30th anniversary is coming up in July. I'm married to Mark Dunley, who's the executive director of the Hunger Action Network. So we always have spirited conversations over dinner. And we have one remarkable son, Reed, who is 24, who went to public school in Rensselaer County, kindergarten through high school. Then he graduated from Vassar and now rides his bicycle all over New York City, works at public radio in New York City by coincidence, and is the lead singer in a punk rock band called Diaper. And when I heard the name of it, I said, cloth or disposable? And he said, Mom, no one's ever asked me that. So I think you can do work-family balance if both parents are, you know, really committed to this. And, you know, 30 years has just flown by in a blink.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. And and ironically, Mark and I are living in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn, and our son is in Williamsburg right next door.
Let me get into the feminism thing with you for a moment. I mean, you're a perfect example of somebody, a woman who has done extremely well in public policy. Has that had any difficulties, any bumps in the road?
Well, no. I mean, often I was the only woman in the room during important meetings. It's not been a problem for me at all because I'm pretty assertive. It's pretty interesting within the environmental field. A lot of women tend to work on health issues. They want to protect their children from excessive pesticides in food or cleaning up toxic waste sites. And a lot of the men work on land preservation and other issues. So I've sort of observed a difference on who works on what issues. But at EPA, it is there are a number of women in leadership positions. And in my experience in state government, you know, I was often the only woman in the room, but it didn't really matter.
Have you ever,
for me,
have you had a single experience in your career in which someone played the card, played the male chauvinist card with you?
Oh, yeah. I lobbied in the state legislature. So,
well, what was that like?
It was mostly positive, but, you know, in the 80s and 90s, there weren't always the most enlightened representatives, and you just sort of work through it.
In the 2000s, do you think that's changed? No, okay, that's a rhetorical question, so I'm just going to leave it there. But I guess I want to ask you, Judith Enck, whether or not you can remember an instance, an example of chauvinism. Nobody ever said, look at dear, you don't understand these things?
Oh, yeah, that, yeah, sure. Yeah. But I remember I was very involved in opposing the siting of a proposed polluting facility.
Yeah.
And a local mayor practically patted me on the head and referred to my work as my hobby. And I think it was more that I was working to protect the environment than being a woman. When I worked real hard to shut down the Albany Answers garbage incinerator, yeah, on Sheridan Avenue before the term environmental justice existed, we knew that there were all this, you know, dioxin and lead and heavy metals coming
hitting
from
minority populations.
Exactly. And we worked so hard to close that down. And the operator of the facility publicly called me a pit bull housewife environmentalist, which I thought was great.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, if you probe a little bit more, I can probably give you tons of examples, but they're not sticking in my mind because they didn't affect what I did. I just kept going.
You were a lobbyist, of course, back in the day, but now you're being lobbied all the time.
Yes.
What's it like to be on the other end? Does it help you that you once did it yourself?
Yeah, it does. You know, I hate long, pointless meetings that are just meet and greets.
Sure.
And so I always urge everyone in the beginning of the meeting, what's your ask? What do you want me to do? And I spend a lot of time explaining what an EPA regional office can do and can't do. I answer all my phone calls. I answer all my emails. I get lots of contacts from citizens across the state who I've never met, but asking me to jump in on a local environmental problem. And, you know, that's often the most rewarding work. We can send an investigator, or rather an inspector, to look at a problem and try to do some problem solving. I spend, this is not a glamorous position. I spend a lot of time dealing with sewage and solid waste and air pollution and doing local problem solving, which is what I love.
So when somebody shows up in your office for an appointment and turns out to be a lunatic, what do you do about that? Or writes you a 10-page, single-spaced letter. You have no idea what the hell they're talking about. How do you handle that?
Sounds
give me a
like,
lesson because I could use it.
Sounds like your mailbox.
Yes, it does.
People don't just show up, but I do get a lot of mail. And, you know, a lot of times people are upset because there's cancer or illness in their family, and they believe there's a linkage to environmental pollution. So that's often not the case, but sometimes it might be. And so I think the first thing is to be empathetic, to be a speed reader, and to go through see, is there something in here we can act on? But, you know, there are some people who've called the EPA office for years and years and years, and they've been dismissed as cranks. And sometimes their concerns are not justified, but sometimes there are. So you've got, I think as a public servant, you've got to, for me, more than you, because, you know, I'm paid by the taxpayers, I've got to keep an open mind and I've got to deal with everything that comes in the door.
Well, I try to keep an open mind, but when some guy calls you on Vox Pop and says day after day after day that the chemtrails are what are causing, that you see in the sky, are what are causing all of our problems, after a while it gets a little
tedious. You can send him to me.
Yeah. Is there anything to that? I mean, do
no.
chemtrails, how do they get up there? Do you know?
I got a letter on this a few weeks ago, and we had staff look into it. I can't speak to the details, but the professional staff have told me there's nothing to be concerned about.
Right. When we look at the bodies of water that are around New York, are we in better or worse shape?
Well, moderately better, but still a long, long way to go. And it's different on every water body. The Great Lakes, the Hudson River, Long Island Sound, Onondaga Lake. One thing they have in common is they all have failing sewage infrastructure on their shores. In the 70s, the federal
government... Even though they say they've cleaned them up.
Right. Well, they have, but now those 40-year-old sewage treatment plants are failing and they need to be upgraded. Statewide, New York needs to spend $20 billion with a B to upgrade sewage treatment plants and drinking water supply plants.
Are they going to do that?
Very slowly, but I don't think they're going to get to the $20 billion anytime soon. That's $20 billion over 20 years, by the way.
How do you get something like that done? Do you sit with the governor? I mean, who makes those decisions?
The governor has to decide whether he wants to invest in upgrading our water systems. I think it makes a lot of sense to do it because we want to meet water quality standards. We want our beaches to be open on hot summer days. And also, building this water infrastructure will create scores of jobs.
Sure.
So that's one of... I thought we were done with sewage. It's so 1970s, but it's back. We have failing sewage treatment plants. We have a problem called combined sewer overflows, where when it rains hard, the stormwater mixes with raw sewage, and you have vast quantities of raw sewage, untreated, going into the Hudson River, for instance.
Our Pete Seeger said that years ago, in the 70s, when he did a series of records and stuff, that soon we'll be swimming in the Hudson. Are we?
Soon. I wouldn't swim in the Hudson after a rainstorm. But the Hudson is definitely improving in water quality. The big ticket item is the PCB cleanup, which has been 30 years in the making.
Could you tell us a little about that?
Sure. For a few decades, General Electric discharged PCBs from two manufacturing plants in Washington County, from Hudson Falls and Fort Edward.
Is that bad? Because we had a governor once who said he'd drink a glass of PCBs. You remember that, Governor Carey?
I do, and thankfully he did not. PCBs...
That's a matter of opinion.
Yeah. PCBs are likely carcinogens. They're neurotoxins. They're reproductive toxins. The problem with having huge quantities of PCBs in the sediment of the Hudson River is the fish eat the plants and we eat the fish. Mm-hmm. And the PCB levels in the fish are so high that you should not eat most species of fish in the Hudson River. It's sort of like the water version of the canary in the coal mine.
Sure.
So just last week, we started year three of PCB dredging. The project is going very well. It should be done in the next 6 to 7 years.
Now, you know that General Electric, resisted this like crazy. They didn't want to do it. They said if we start mucking about and taking this stuff out of the river, that we would just make it worse.
Right.
Has that turned out to be true?
That's turned out to be absolutely false. We have studies looking at resuspension. It's not a problem. So I know GE resisted this for years, which is unfortunate because every year that this project didn't happen, more and more PCBs move south, eventually making their way to New York Harbor. But now that they are focused on the project, GE is doing a good job. They've decided to stop fighting this, to comply with the law, and they are doing a good job getting the PCBs out of the bottom of the Hudson.
Well, let me ask you a question just from what you just said. Most of it is up near us, but as it gets down to New York, are they planning to dredge down there too?
No, the Superfund site is a 40-mile stretch of the Hudson from Washington County to Troy, and that's where the hot spots are. So we're not dredging all of the PCBs out of the river because that's virtually impossible, but we've done a lot of mapping and we are dredging the most toxic areas where you have a concentration of PCBs.
Yeah.
That's the best we can do. And that's the sad reality of this legacy.
Yeah, but if Pete goes swimming down in a beacon. If you swallow some water, we'll be ingesting some PCBs?
Not necessarily, because the PCBs are in the sediment. They build up in the fish. Peat can go swimming in beacon if it has not recently rained and if he's aware of local, you know, hotspots. And I'm glad you mentioned Pete Seeger. No one has done more to clean up the Hudson than he. And one of the challenges of this work is we're looking, you know, 10, 20, 30 years out for results. I think Pete is 93. So we need to get this done quickly. We don't have a lot of time.
When you were working for Governor Patterson, I picked up the phone one day and called you with a great idea, which was we should name the bridge over the Hudson the Pete Seeger Bridge. Everybody got on board. You got on board. The governor got on board. The legislature got on board. Everybody was going to do it. One day the phone rings and there's grandson Tao who says to me, "Grandpa says, cut it out."
Yep, I remember.
He doesn't want it. We had it all lined up.
I know. That's so typical of Pete Seeger.
It is.
He's so modest.
He's been offered a billion honorary doctorates. He doesn't take them. Yeah. You know, he doesn't go. The one he took was the Kennedy honor. And the other thing that made me weep, I don't know about you, was seeing him at the inauguration singing with
was amazing.
With Arlo.
He is one of a kind and such a treasure for the Hudson River Valley. And we're all better because of him. And even though Walkway Over the Hudson in Poughkeepsie is not named after Pete Seeger, it is an amazing park and resource for the people of the Hudson Valley. If you haven't been there, you must go. Connects Ulster County to Poughkeepsie, and it's just amazing. One of the really fun things I worked on in the governor's office, which came up from the grassroots. There was this little group called Walkway Over the Hudson, and then they teamed up with the Dyson Foundation. It was an abandoned rail bridge, and it would have been more expensive to take the bridge down than to restore it into a walkway. People love the outdoors, and so it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Tappan Zee Bridge, which very much needs to be replaced. There's now this sort of modest grassroots movement going on suggesting that if you build a new bridge, leave the old Tappan Zee Bridge in place and use that as a walkway, bikeway.
Wow. Talk to me about bikes. I have a cousin who lives in Prospect Park.
Oh, don't tell me he or she is against bike paths along Prospect Park.
Absolutely. Take away the parking spaces and all the rest of it. Would we be better off with a lot more bikes? I know you've already indicated your son rides all over New York on a bicycle.
It terrifies me riding all over New York. But look, without the subway system in New York City, you wouldn't move, 5 million people a day on the subways. I think Mayor Bloomberg deserves enormous credit and his transportation commissioner for promoting bike paths. It takes some time to get used to. You have to look both ways as a pedestrian. And, people are used to looking for cars. They're not used to looking for bikes. But from an environmental perspective, in terms of air quality and then the health of people who are bicycling, bikes in cities are pivotal. There was just an article in the New York Times about Los Angeles embracing bikes. When I'm in Washington, D.C., they have these sort of short-term bike rentals. You can slide your credit card in and rent a bike for an hour. I haven't done it because they don't also rent helmets.
Interesting.
But more and more cities are promoting bicycling, and from an environmental perspective, it's terrific.
And I know New York, Bloomberg is pushing that like crazy right now.
Yes.
And getting a certain amount of grief for it.
A certain amount of grief, but mostly support. Most polls show a support for bicycling in New York City.
I divide bicycle riders into two groups in New York City where I spend a good deal of time. One of them are the people like your son. You know, they get from A to B. And then there are the delivery guys, and many of them are really out of their minds in terms of you really could get killed very easily.
Yeah, the messenger guys or the food delivery guys?
Both.
Yeah, the messenger guys are pretty aggressive. But it's part of living in New York City. You just always have to watch where you're walking. The amazing thing is the people on the cell phones, on the Blackberries, as they are walking through traffic. I think that's more of a traffic hazard than bicycles.
Well, now that we're talking about New York City, I wanted to ask you about dog poop. Now, you know, that's a pretty serious environmental hazard, isn't it? I mean, you know, that stuff carries a lot of... Now, I have a dog, Murray, and we talk and go around and we pick up behind him vary, but they also lift their legs and squat and make a lot of urine. Have we ever thought about whether or not that constitutes an environmental hazard?
Well, sadly, I was just thinking about this last week walking through the streets of Brooklyn. People are doing a terrific job picking up dog poop, but the liquid waste is just showering our trees. And I have not seen any studies on this, but as I was walking...
Well, we don't allow human beings to pee in the streets.
True. Well, most people, that's good.
Well, most people, but I'm assuming that...
It can't be good.
It can't be good, yeah.
It can't be good, but I have to say that's one issue I'm not working on.
Oh, well, just put it on your list, will you please? It is of great concern to me, although I don't know what would happen with Murray. I don't know whether you could have
a diaper?
Dog in the streets and...
God. I don't know. It's not really practical. Uh-huh. I'm going to let you lead that charge.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a column. Okay, let me ask you this. Is there ever a point where you just get terribly frustrated by all of this?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Usually around 8:30 at night when I'm stuck in my office trying to make a decision or deal with a problem. I start out every day very optimistic. And as the hours tick by, you know, it's sort of the more you know, the more you say, why am I doing this? But, you know, I think you need sort of an appreciation for incrementalism and that little steps get us to the right spot. But if you look at this nation's energy choices, transportation choices, toxic legacy, the number of hours and the billions of dollars cleaning up federal Superfund sites, old dry cleaner sites, just because they didn't do it right the first time, is astonishing.
Now, I would be remiss, Judith Ink, and if you think you've gotten away with it, you haven't, not to ask you the fracking question.
I knew it was coming. Fracking? I haven't heard of fracking.
Well, we have a president of the United States who says he's for all energy development.
Yes.
Nuclear, fracking, you name it. But up here in this region, fracking is seen by many people as the devil's work. We have a governor who I think is leaning towards fracking. I mean, the evidence would seem that way. You can't fool me. And I wonder, you know, whether you could give us some insights into all of this.
Sure. You got about 6 hours?
No, I got about 7 minutes.
2 minutes. As you say, the president has said that natural gas plays a key role in our nation's clean energy future. He views it as a bridge fuel. He's very supportive of renewable energy, but he believes that there's not enough renewable energy output from solar and wind and geothermal and tidal to hold us over. And so thus natural gas plays a key role. But he's also said that he wants it done safely. And it's been, you know, very interesting watching this issue develop in New York. New York is very different than Pennsylvania.
Is Pennsylvania one of your states?
No, no. That's Region 3. But I've been watching Pennsylvania very, very closely, and I want to make sure that the mistakes that occurred there do not happen in New York.
Well, I just recently had some pro-frackers on here, as a matter of fact, two groups, and they all say basically nothing bad happened in Pennsylvania.
Well, I wish that was the case, but there are some issues. With
what are they?
Methane in water supplies, proper disposal of frack fluid. Not in Pennsylvania, but in Ohio, there was a concern with not the fracking process itself, but one method used to dispose of frack fluid, the flowback water, is to do deep well injection of that as a disposal approach. And there's growing concern that there's seismic impacts from
that. Otherwise known as earthquakes.
Yeah. So Ohio on New Year's Eve last year had a sizable earthquake. And so the USGS and other scientists are now very closely looking at potential problems with earthquakes. As a rule, I think you don't want any energy extraction activity to cause earthquakes. I can say that with certainty. So They have not had that problem in Pennsylvania, but they have in other states. So we're looking closely at Pennsylvania. New York has the benefit of seeing how well it has or hasn't played out in Pennsylvania and Texas and Wyoming and Colorado and other places. And I have to give DEC Commissioner Joe Martens credit for being very careful and deliberative in looking at this issue. They have a supplemental generic environmental impact statement out on the street. I would urge your listeners to look at the comments, the public comments that EPA submitted on that document, very detailed technical comments giving suggestions on how to avoid water pollution, air pollution. And I think the state should carefully look at the 60 to 70,000 public comments that have come in.
Yeah, I'll take them to bed tonight.
A lot of them are repetitive, yeah. But, a lot of them, like the EPA comments, are, I think, very important and detailed. And, the state should take its time, okay. As they are.
Okay. Now, you have a president who
yes.
has made a policy pronouncement on this. I believe the governor of New York, from my perspective, is taking a policy position on this. You're basically a bureaucrat, but do you have to do what he says, what the president says? I just heard you go about as far, as they said in Everything's Up to Date in Kansas City, about as far as we can go. But do you sort of have to follow the rules, right?
I'm a presidential appointee, but I also, as a bureaucrat, have to follow the law and science. And nothing that the president has said is contradictory to what I just said. He wants to see hydrofracking occur, but safely. And that's the issue, is how do you do it safely? This is a new technology to New York. High volume slick water hydrofracking is new to New York. New York has a long history of natural gas drilling, mostly in Western New York, but that's conventional natural gas drilling. This is a little different. So I don't think anyone in the administration would disagree with the advice of being deliberate and careful with this.
Do you think we'll ever get Americans out of their cars?
Not anytime soon, but if mass transit is more accessible, we will. I take the subway to work every day. It's so easy and so affordable.
Yeah.
I try to take mass transit as I go through New York and New Jersey, which means for the first time in years, I'm on the bus a lot from Syracuse to Albany. And why is it that I haven't been on the bus in 20 years? So it's we've got to make it affordable, accessible. If that happens, people will more easily get out of their cars. And as the price of gas goes up, speaking of cars, one of EPA's great successes in the last few years has been dramatic improvements in fuel efficiency standards, making cars and light trucks more fuel efficient. So it's not only getting out of cars and promoting mass transit and bicycling and walking, it's also making sure that our vehicles are as efficient as they can be when it comes to consuming petroleum.
My thesis is that as soon as everybody gets 60 miles a gallon on their car, the oil companies will raise it to $11 a gallon. In other words, you will never get a break.
Yeah, well, it is going up. I bought the first year Prius,
yeah.
And it's the oddest thing. The older the car got, the better mileage I got. So when we finally traded it in for a Honda Insight recently, we were getting 50 miles per gallon.
Now, is a Honda Insight a
hybrid?
Hybrid.
Yeah.
And the basic principle is?
It's battery and combustion engine, and the battery is charged every time you hit the brake.
Yeah.
So it switches back and forth.
Amazing.
And it gets great mileage.
How much?
When we turned in the Prius, we were getting between 45 and 50 miles per
gallon.
And
what about this? What about the Honda?
This one's getting about 40. I wish it was a little better. But the reason we bought it was not just fuel efficiency, but the tailpipe pollution is cut by like 90%. Right. It's a very efficient car.
I got to get me one of them.
You do. Absolutely.
No question. Well, Judith Enck, we truly love you and admire you. And you have been such a great pal to this radio station over the years. You've always been here for us. And this is another good example. I tell you, at the beginning, you said, how are we going to do this for an hour? I said, that's not going to be hard. And it wasn't hard. And we thank you for being here. Our guest has been Judith Enck, Regional Administrator of Region 2 for the United States Environment Protection Agency. Let me just tell everybody, that's a big job, a position she's held since her appointment in 2009. Judith, again, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Alan. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.